Welcome to Look Ahead Radio and Viewpoints Around the World. My name is Tom Arms, and in a moment we'll be joined by my old friend Lockwood Phillips. We live on opposite sides of the Atlantic, London and North Carolina. We also have opposing political views. Once a week we telephonically connect and try to put the world to rights. Hope you enjoy this week's effort.
Welcome to Look Ahead Radio with Tom Arms and Lockwood Phillips.
Viewpoints around the world this evening with Tom Arms. And just a quick note, Tom is talking to me. We are pre-recording this program. The reason to give him some opportunity to recover from his flight from the States back to his adopted home, London, England. But want to get him on the air with us immediately. And just to remind you, this portion has been pre-recorded to accommodate his rather weary bones. And with that, Tom, good afternoon, or in your case, good evening, and thanks for joining us.
Oh, good evening, Lockwood. I'm very jet-lagged.
I bet you are. Okay, before we get into jet lag, very quickly, temperature, climate, environment there in London now that you returned, do you miss the States already?
You know, it's very similar to New York. I spent the day in New York with my daughter, who's over there for a few months, and we had a great time, and it was chilly but sunny, and it's more or less the same here. It's sort of early spring weather, very sunny, blue skies again, but the leaves are out. It's very pleasant. You know, I've been very hot there in the south. Yeah, you know, I was down there in North Carolina and Virginia. I can't take the heat.
All right. And then the other question, of course, is now that you're back in London and the UK, any sense of loss or missing the States? It's been a while. I know you periodically visit, but I'm just curious, do you have this hankering to ever return home to your homeland?
Oh, sometimes. You know, America is home, but so is London. Yeah. And I've been here for 45 years. It's you feel a bit of schizophrenia.
Understood. I appreciate that.
All right, do anyway.
Let's talk about your flight. We've been hearing a variety of stories here in the States recently related to unhappy passengers and disruptions on airplanes. And I'm curious, what was your experience? How did it go? How was the flight?
Well, the departure was delayed for an hour and a half, but they supplied us with more or less unlimited popcorn, sweets, and soda. So we were all happily munching away on popcorn and sucking boiled sweets and drinking Diet Cokes and things. On the flight itself, it was lovely. They were very nice people. I managed to get three seats myself and stretched out and had a snooze before arriving in London. It wasn't very crowded.
You know, this is the second time you said your flight to the States was very sparse as well. That's interesting. I'm curious if this has anything to do with international issues, namely terrorism. You may not have even asked that question, but I'm just curious, did that question ever come up as to why there?
Well, I think if I'd asked the question, I might have been arrested. You know, that's sort of questions you don't ask while going through security or sitting on a plane.
That's probably.
I did have a bottle of Trump wine, which I bought at Charlottesville, Virginia, at the Trump Winery. It was a very nice wine, and I was going to save it for Thanksgiving, but unfortunately, I made the mistake of putting it in my hand luggage, and it was confiscated.
No. Obviously, somebody really wanted that Trump wine. That's unfortunate. But at the same time, I can appreciate you wanting to put that in your travel luggage as well, your hand luggage. All right, we're going to move on to other items, but I just was curious how the flight progressed. Let's talk about some of the events of the past week and going forward. I think of particular note, one that we've discussed on numerous occasions, and I want to get your opinion. And yes, I'm going to even allow you to gloat a little bit. The French election. Jeremy Macron won the election. Interestingly enough, I just have to make note of this, Tom. Only 60% of the French population, and that's a rough number, voted, roughly, well, closer to 66%. 30% stayed out of the election and completely. What does this portend for his reign as, I shouldn't say reign, but as his job as the new prime minister?
Well, as European elections go, 60% is not too far off the norm. Marine Le Pen was hoping to get. She didn't expect to win. At least that's what I had been hearing. She didn't expect to win. She was very disappointed in the amount she got. She was hoping to get at least 40% of the vote. And the fact that she was beaten so well by Emmanuel Macron does not portend well for the National Front. They're talking about reorganizing the party. She's not been helped by the fact that her daughter has said that after the election, she's dropping out of politics because her daughter was seen as the successor to Marie Le Pen. So it, I think we're going to have a reorganization of the far right in French politics.
What does this portend for the whole issue of French politics? There is, seems to be at least, some frustration within France still and in the aftermath of this election, because Emmanuel Macron also has to develop a coalition in the French parliament. And that's going to be difficult, is it not?
It's going to be very difficult. I mean, at the moment, his party, En Marche, is one member. Him.
Wow.
He has no seats in parliament. And there are people who were socialists. There are people who were on the right wing who have said they would defect to his new party. But he has to somehow or another form a coalition. Now, the French president has quite a few powers, probably a bit more than the U.S. president. But he still has to get things through the National Assembly. The elections to the National Assembly will be held next month. He will be putting forward candidates. I doubt if they will be able to get enough to form a majority. So he's going to have to figure out how to develop a coalition.
Well, you know, the other aspect of some of his platform involved some rather tough financial decisions on the part of the French government and also the French the French population. There was some observations that among his platforms, his policies that he hopes to institute, was actually a reduction in the government labor pool, also trying to raise the budget income for the French government and the operations of France. There are some aspects of his platform that are strikingly conservative, are there not?
Well, let's say they're common sense. The French have always had very strong state controls over labor and working conditions and things like that. And it's always been a political football. They don't have, it's not a very business-friendly society. And whether you're socialist or whether you're in the Republican Party or in the National Front, Emmanuel Macron's background is from the business community. In that sense, he has a lot in common with Donald Trump. It's going to be very interesting whether or not he can move the control of the economic apparatus out of the state and into business hands again. He's a centrist. He likes to have policies which make sense rather than stand on a particular right-wing or left-wing political platform.
How long will it take for us to understand just how successful this election will be for any of the current policies within France? Let's say, for example, the maintenance of the European Union, which, by the way, Emmanuel Macron has actually suggested a review of the EU relationship and contract. How long will it take before we start seeing some real outcome of this election?
I think we're talking about the new year. And as for the EU, I think Macron is very pro-EU. There's little doubt about that. And his promise to review the EU was more cosmetic than anything else.
Well, and of course,
I mean, there's always room for improvement. But I think he's starting from a premise of being in favor of the EU as opposed to where Marie Le Pen stood from the start. And that is very much against the EU.
All right, we're going to get back to this in just a moment with Tom Arms of Look Ahead Radio and lookaheadnews.com. Look Ahead Radio, of course, heard every Friday afternoon here on this talk station and stations around the world, literally, not figuratively, but literally, and of course, of lookaheadnews.com.
Look Ahead Radio will return in just a moment.
This is Tom Arms of LookAheadNews.com's expanded world analysis for the week being the 15th of May. Look Ahead broadcasts tomorrow's news today so that you can plan to participate. Sacked FBI Director James Comey on Tuesday appears before the Senate committee investigating the Russian hacking scandal. His appearance is expected to pour more oil on accusations that the White House is guilty of a cover-up. Another problem for President Trump is his proposed travel ban, which has been blocked by the courts. On Monday, the Seattle Appeals Court will hear the administration's appeal against the Hawaiian judge's injunction against blocking travel from specified Muslim countries. The travel ban will be top of the agenda when the president meets at the White House on Monday with Abu Dhabi's Crown Prince Sheikh Mohammed bin Zayed Al Nahyan. Also on the agenda will be Yemen, Syria, the Iran nuclear deal, and fighting jihadism. Drugs, organized crime, and the Colombian peace process will be discussed when Colombian President Juan Manuel Santos arrives in Washington on Thursday for talks with President Trump. President Trump also meets on Tuesday with Turkish President Erdogan. On the agenda are Syria and the fate of Fethullah Gulen, the U.S.-based cleric accused of plotting against Erdogan. Turkey is heavily involved in Syria, and Tuesday sees the next round of UN-sponsored Geneva talks between the Syrian government and the rebels. The talks follow a Russian-organized initiative to set up de-escalation zones in Syria. Elsewhere in the Middle East, it is presidential election day in Iran on Friday. The most likely winner is incumbent Hassan Rouhani. Terrorism in Afghanistan will be discussed next week at NATO and EU meetings. The NATO meeting is seen as a test of European resolve to contribute more to the war on terrorism. Elsewhere in Europe, newly elected French President Emmanuel Macron is expected to name his prime minister on Monday. The favorite for the job is former Socialist Prime Minister Manuel Valls, who switched parties after Macron's victory. The new PM will have the tough job of running a coalition after National Assembly elections in June. Troubled Greece faces a 24-hour general strike on Wednesday by the country's two biggest unions, the General Confederation of Employees of Greece and the Civil Servants Union Federation. The unions are protesting against fresh austerity measures proposed by the government. Energy is the subject of a Swiss referendum on Sunday. The issue is whether to accept the government's energy strategy, which seeks to phase out nuclear energy and increase renewable energy and energy efficiency. The government plan is opposed by the Swiss People's Party. And that was next week's News Today from LookAheadNews.com, so that you can plan to participate in the world around you. Stay tuned for Viewpoints Around the World with myself and Lockwood Phillips.
Welcome back to Look Ahead Radio. Here is Lockwood Phillips.
Viewpoints Around the World with Tom Arms this afternoon, joining us earlier in the day. We are pre-recording this portion of the program to give him accommodations to get caught up from jet lag. He has just returned home from a two-week visit here in the States. And Tom, we were just chatting a moment ago about the fallout or the aftermath of the French election. And I do have a quick note on that Twitter scandal. Let's talk about that very quickly.
Well, yeah, I mean, it's very interesting. The French elections are designed so that the last day before the voting, you're not allowed to talk at all about the elections. There's not allowed to be any political talk. And that's binding on all the candidates and all the newspapers, legally binding. Well, just before that started, there was a huge Twitter dump on anti-Macron conspiracies and things like that. Now, it's not clear yet where it came from, but what is clear that Macron couldn't really dispute any of it because it would have led to him breaking the law. A lot of people think it's almost an alliance between the Russians. This is what they're saying at the moment, between the Russians and the alt-right in America. It seems to have originated from an ISP in, I think, Latvia, and then dumped onto Twitter. And then it looks as if it was pre-organized. You started getting a lot of responses and everything from alt-right groups in the United States in such a way that it had to be pre-organized.
Wow. So there is some opinion that the Russians were trying to involve themselves in this election as well?
As well as alt-right groups in the U.S.
I can't imagine the alt-right groups, but frankly, I'm a little surprised that...
I'm just reporting what has been written here. They have no proof about anything. Let me add that. That cachet. They have no proof about anything. They're still investigating it, and it may take some time because there's all sorts of smoke and mirrors and everything else to protect the source.
Well,
but this is apparently where it appears to be pointing.
Okay. We'll be paying close attention to that. Again, Tom Arms of LookAheadNews.com and Look Ahead Radio. And with LookAheadNews.com, that's a free service. Just simply log on and join his regular news feeds. Free, I might add, LookAheadNews.com. That's tomorrow's news today. Let's move on to the impact of the French elections on the British elections and also the future of the British elections. And I also want to throw in the upcoming German elections as well. The fact that Emmanuel Macron has won the election, does this secure first, very quickly, the German elections for, and that's coming up, I think, in June, is that correct? For Chancellor Merkel?
It certainly doesn't help the Alternative for Deutschland, who have really been slipping in the polls anyway.
Okay.
Now, it has become a two-horse race between the Social Democratic Party, led by Martin Schulz, which is also known as the SPD, and Angela Merkel's CDU, stroke CSU coalition. At the moment, the SPD is well ahead of it. What effect does that have on Europe? Well, both of those parties, both of them, are 110% behind the EU. There's like a fag papers or a paper-thin difference between them on foreign policy.
So, in essence, the EU is on solid ground, and let's then move over to the issue of Great Britain or United Kingdom, and of course, you have an election coming up there as well. What impact did the French election have on Prime Minister, Theresa May. What impact has that had on her efforts? Because she's called an election for June as well, has she not?
Yes, the 8th of June. Mm-hmm. I think she always thought there was going to be a threat from UKIP. And certainly if Marie Le Pen had done better, it would have helped UKIP. But they have now dropped to 3 or 4% in the opinion polls. They're almost dropping out of sight. They were dropping before the elections in France. It looks as if this has, it certainly hasn't helped them. It must have damaged them. And they're also not being helped by the fact they seem to be fighting amongst themselves.
Now, you say UTIP. Tell folks what this organization...
UK Independence Party.
UK, okay. And that is a relatively weak party to begin with, is it not?
It is, but they did very well in campaigning for exit from the EU. They took the leading role in Brexit.
Mm-hmm.
And the thought was that because they did so well in campaigning for Brexit, that people would want to vote for them in the general election. And that is not happening. What is happening is people said, well, you did your job. You got us out of the EU. Goodbye.
Now, that is Jeremy Corbyn. Is that correct?
No, that is Nigel Farage.
Nigel Farage.
No, the leader.
Okay, that's right. Okay.
That's Nigel Farage. You're a good buddy.
Right. And Nigel Farage.
Nigel Farage, he's no longer a leader. He's not running in the election. The new leader of the UK Independence Party is Paul Nuttall.
Okay. And by the way, Nigel Farage will be here in the States. He's attending the Civitas Leadership Conference, which will be conducted in Raleigh. And the date of that escapes me at this point. But if anybody's interested, they can go to the website, nccivitas.org and see the lineup for those speakers, and one of them being Nigel Farage. All right, looking at that and moving on, what impact, any at all, for Theresa May as far as her efforts? And she's trying herself to build a coalition in Parliament, is she not?
No, she's not so much trying to build a coalition, other than a coalition between members of her own party.
Right.
She's trying to increase a majority, and it looks as if she will substantially increase a majority in the June election. And the idea, what she is saying publicly, the idea is that she wants to strengthen her hand for negotiations with the EU.
And how is that going, by the way, the negotiations with the EU?
Well, there are no real negotiations at the moment. I think everyone is waiting for the result of the British elections. There are no real negotiations. Certainly, it looks as if Theresa May will get her increased majority. There were local elections in the UK last Thursday, and the Conservative Party more or less swept the boards. Labour is just shooting. It's, as I told people, it's aiming the gun at its foot and somehow or another shooting itself in the head.
All right. Tom Arms of lookaheadnews.com and Look Ahead Radio. A little humor there. All right, Tom, I want to go back to Germany for a moment. We've got about just a few moments before we go to the next break. You've mentioned here the extreme right-wing movement in Germany, and we talked about that in relationship to, as I recall, a potential assassination attempt, something of that nature. Am I confusing issues here?
No, you're not. In fact, it's the same issue. Okay. They have ordered an investigation. They've ordered the search of all military barracks in Germany for Nazi material. They've arrested another three army officers in the plot to kill the German president. Now, the idea was, if you recall, that there was an army lieutenant who was posing as a Syrian refugee, and he developed an identity as a Syrian refugee, and he was going to go out and assassinate the German president, and then it was going to be pinned on a Syrian refugee. So that's what it is. The defense minister, a lady called Ursula von Leyden, has said that there are plots within the German military, and that the German military has what she calls an attitude problem towards refugees and towards the right wing. This has not made her popular with the German military chiefs, but they are going along with the search of all barracks.
Interesting. All right. I gather that very quickly that this is of interest to the rest of Europe. They're paying attention to this.
Oh, yes. Oh, yes, indeed. Right. I mean, the Germans and everyone in Europe are very sensitive to the right wing and the rise of the right wing in Germany. They're very sensitive to Germany's Nazi past.
Understood.
I mean, people in America, because you're so far away, may have forgotten about it. I'll tell you the story. We went on holiday, a cycling holiday in the Netherlands, and we were talking to our guide. And as we approached the German border, I said, "How are relations with Germany?" And this is a man who is in his late 30s. So, you know, he's not exactly millennial, but he certainly doesn't remember the war because he wasn't there. And he said, "We will do business with the Germans, but we will never trust them."
Interesting. All right. And this is an important part of the conversation. It is the historic relevance of past experiences, and particularly in Europe. And of course, we won't belabor the issue, but that even gets to the issue of the European Union and one of the reasons for the European Union, and is to create that homogeny, if you will, of Europe. All right, we're going to get back to this and more in just a few moments with Tom Arms of lookaheadnews.com and, of course, Look Ahead Radio. You're listening to Viewpoints Around the World.
Look Ahead Radio will return in just a moment. We now return to Look Ahead Radio. Here is Lockwood Phillips.
Viewpoints Around the World with Tom Arms of lookaheadnews.com and Look Ahead Radio. Joining us this afternoon, again, we are pre-recording this. He is suffering from jet lag. I had the pleasure of flying from west to east, which, Tom, as you mentioned in your email to me, is a lot more onerous than going from east to west. And so I can appreciate the weariness that you've experienced. And but thank you for being with us this evening. Let's move on to a few other items as we begin to wrap this up. Some of the issues that we've been paying close attention to here in the States, and one I want to touch on, NATO troops in Afghanistan. And there's debate right now in Washington, D.C. about additional U.S. troops going to Afghanistan. Tell us what NATO's opinion is on the future of Afghanistan.
They are discussing it. The British have been asked to send at least another 500 to 1,000 troops, which is going to be difficult for the British Prime Minister Theresa May to agree to in the middle of an election. But she has a meeting shortly with Jens Stoltenberg, the NATO Secretary General. I think that this is an early test for America's European allies to prove that they can come up to the mark. As I understand it, the U.S. is saying, we want you to take on a bigger load in Afghanistan proportionate to what you had before. And that if you do take on a bigger load, then we will stop talking about things like obsolescence. Maybe we even, you know, will be a bit easier on that 2% business. And I think you've got a meeting on the 25th of May, and it's going to be discussed there. And I think decisions will be made at that time. What they will be, I think probably Trump will get his way.
All right. Now, I want to go back to something. The 2%, what are we talking about there?
That's a few years ago, all the European allies agreed that they would increase their spending on defense to 2%, a minimum of 2% of GDP.
Gotcha.
U.S. defending on defense, I can't remember, is it 3% or 4%?
A number.
There are only about, at the moment, four or five Europeans who, in fact, spend 2% mm-hmm. of their GDP on defense.
Okay. All right. And so we're looking, what is the opinion of NATO and Europe about Afghanistan? Because, as we both know, it's the graveyard of empires.
It is the graveyard of empires. I think they have largely taken the lead from the U.S. on this one. If the U.S. is willing to be involved, then they will stand by them. I think, as well as being the graveyard for empires, it is the incubator for terrorism.
It is. Yeah. And that, of course, is the continued concern. All right, let's move on to a few other items here. Syria rebels leaving Damascus. And of course, what is the future of Syria? And by the way, you may not be aware of this, but President Trump has shown an inclination to supply arms to the Kurds in Syria.
Yes, I have seen that.
And that's making Turkey a little uncomfortable. Turkey is...
It is. It is making Turkey uncomfortable.
It is the cloud over... You know, we say Syria and Syria and Iran are the cloud of the Middle East. The real cloud and the fog is Turkey. We never know what's going to happen there.
No, we don't, you know, and every time the U.S. or the U.S. Or the Europeans make a anti-Turkish move, that pushes Turkey a bit closer to Iran and Russia and Syria. And at the moment, Turkey is a member of the Honest Broker Group, which includes Iran, Turkey, and Russia, who are trying to negotiate a deal to end the civil war in Syria. And they have just agreed to a pause in fighting and airstrikes for 6 months in around the rebel-held areas, unhindered aid deliveries, and the return of displaced civilians. And that is part of that agreement has led to the withdrawal of 1,500 families from the rebel-held areas in Damascus to another place called Idlib. Now, the rebels haven't agreed to this. In fact, they walked out of a meeting last week in Kazakhstan, but they're going along with it. It's a sort of de facto agreement, if you like.
Right.
And the others who haven't agreed to it is the Syrians. the government of Assad. And he's saying, well, he'll think about going along with it as long as there are no breaches in the agreement to which he hasn't agreed.
Well, obviously, we're now no closer to an understanding agreement or solution than we were a year ago.
Now, can I just add one thing, though,
sure,
which would give heart to the Trump administration and probably to anyone listening, is also part of this agreement, non-agreement, is that the rebels would join forces with the Assad people and the Russians, Iranians and Turks to fight against the jihadists.
I wouldn't want to. That's a train wreck. I can tell you that without even going any further. Let's move on. Amazing. Let's move to an issue that involves both China and the U.S. and we'll go all the way back to France. Paris Climate Accord. I know that there's a meeting in Paris this week. What is the news on that? Is there a lot of coverage there in the UK and in Europe? And how intense is this this meeting? What can you tell us about it?
It's an implementation meeting. It's in Bonn, by the way, not Paris, but it's a meeting in Bonn of the Paris Climate Agreement.
Grand, thank you for clarification.
So you're halfway there. Okay. It's very interesting. It's almost a virtual meeting with people from all over the world coming in on webcasts to take part in it. I think what's interesting in it, behind it, is that the Chinese president is taking such an active role. As soon as Emmanuel Macron was elected, he phoned him up and said, congratulations. And by the way, I want to tell you the one thing I really want to get behind is climate change and the Paris Agreement. And I want to make certain that we're in one when we're talking at the Bonn implementation talks. So the Chinese are really pushing this at the moment. And the Europeans have been pushing it for a long time.
You know, the fascinating aspect of this is China is one of the major polluters in the world. And we're here in the States kind of wondering, what do they tend to gain from this other than possibly pushing down on other countries in their productivity and their use of energy, namely the United States? But that's one of the arguments that's being considered here in this country.
Yes, I think I'll have to disagree with you on that, Lockwood. You'd be surprised to hear.
I'm very surprised.
I know. Yeah, I'm glad you're sitting down. You are sitting down, aren't you?
I am sitting down. Thank you. So?
No, I think it's more a case of the Chinese know that this is a major domestic political issue.
Pardon me.
And the Chinese have to do something about it.
Wait a second.
China.
Wait a second. A major domestic issue for China? China's concerned
yes.
about?
Let me explain why.
Please.
The air pollution in China is so bad that according to an American group called Barclay something or another, a nonprofit group, it's equivalent to smoking 40 cigarettes a day. And they claim that 4,000 people a day die due to air pollution. Now, I know that's just one aspect of pollution, but it's an important aspect. And so there's a lot of talk in the Chinese press. There's a lot of talk about in war posters and everything else about the need for the government to do more about pollution. And so that's one of the big reasons they are behind pushing for the climate change accord, because it will have a big impact on what's happening domestically in China. It will help the Chinese Communist Party to stay in power if it is seen to be doing something about pollution.
That is surprising in light of the fact that they've continued to bring more coal companies online, or coal-fired furnaces
they're
online.
They're phasing out coal stations and trying to replace them with nuclear. It is, and they do have a toxic waste problem. I think what you have is a situation where you had breakneck industrialization for 25 years, and they are paying the price for it now. But it was industrialized quick, clean up later.
Well, it will be interesting to see how this pans out.
I think that was their policy.
All right. Very quickly, the absence or the casual nature that the U.S. has taken to this, what's the opinion in the European Union, or pardon me, in Europe and UK?
Well, they think that eventually the U.S. will come back on board. And it was very interesting. I don't know if you knew, but there was supposed to be a meeting on Tuesday in the White House to discuss exactly what the U.S. would do about this implementation, these implementation talks. And the meeting was postponed. And what I've heard is the meeting was postponed because there were people in the White House who could not agree on the climate change position. Hmm. You had Scott Pruitt and Steve Bannon on one side, according to my sources, who were very much opposed to the idea of participating in climate change talks. And then on the other extreme, you had Ivanka and Jared Kushner, who were very much in favor of participating in climate change talks. And in the middle, you had Rex Tillerson saying, well, maybe not.
All right. Well, we're going to get back to the White House here in just a moment with Tom Arms. We're going to chat with him about the stories associated with the announcement yesterday on the dismissal of James Comey, director of the FBI. You're listening to Viewpoints Around the World with Tom Arms.
Look Ahead Radio will return in just a moment.
Observations of an Expat by Tom Arms. God is infallible, although you could argue that he made a big mistake when he, or she, scooped up a mess of Middle Eastern mud and sculpted atom. The first Chinese is reported to have enjoyed a similar creation, although the river was the Yangtze. As for India's Hindus, the first man was the result of a passionate coupling of Brahma and the goddess Shatrupa. But all religions have this in common, the infallibility of God. It is accepted by everyone who accepts the existence of God. For centuries in the West, the concept of infallibility also extended to God's representatives on earth, from the Pope to a lowly parish priest. Even monarchs were divinely chosen to rule over lesser human beings. The Age of Enlightenment put an end to that. The execution of England's King Charles I started the head rolling, so to speak, on the issue of the divine right of monarchs. The French Revolution finished the job. As for clerical infallibility, the Pope still claims perfection, but only in matters of doctrine. In Judaism, there are a group of ultra-Orthodox rabbis who've tried to don the mantle, mainly to support their claim to an Eretz Israel. Contrary to public opinion, no contemporary fundamentalist Islamic cleric claims the role. They use the recorded teachings of Muhammad and his immediate followers to impose a God-centered political structure, which is almost but not quite the same thing. The problem with human infallibility, whether it comes from God's anointed or self-proclaimed representative or simply a hack politician, is that it stifles debate in one fell stroke. If it is impossible for someone to be wrong, then there's no room for disagreement, discussion, or improvement. That is why it is disturbing that President Trump recently signed an executive order effectively restoring tax-free status to churches who use their pulpits for political purposes. For decades, there's been a growing trend among America's evangelical clergy to use a self-proclaimed personal relationship with God to push the conservative political agenda. God revealed to me. God told me. God came to me. Their congregations believe them. They're told to believe in God, and that if they believe in God, they should believe in the Word of God as interpreted for them by their spiritual leaders. This, of course, blurs the separation line between church and state, upon which successive U.S. Supreme Courts have insisted since 1870. There is a misconception that the Constitution decrees separation of church and state. The First Amendment protects religious freedom, and Article 6 prohibits religious tests for public officials. But nowhere in the U.S. Constitution does it explicitly state that church and state must remain forever separate. The phrase separation of church and state came from the pen of that well-known religious skeptic Thomas Jefferson. In 1802, he wrote to a Baptist church that Congress should, quote, make no law respecting an establishment of religion or prohibiting the free exercise thereof, thus building a wall of separation of church and state, end quote. Generations of Supreme Court justices have merely accepted Jefferson's interpretation, even though no amendment, specific legislation, or executive order has been passed on the issue, and Jefferson himself never sat on the court. Separation of church and state is more of a tradition than a law, and it is a tradition which has spread beyond American shores to become the norm throughout the West and other parts of the world seeking to advance their society. And where the separation has been applied, political and economic success has usually followed. Those countries who have blurred the distinction between church and state have, by and large, atrophied. So, why, in the words of retired Justice Sandra Day O'Connor, should America trade in a system that has served us so well for one that has served others so poorly?
Welcome back to Look Ahead Radio. Here is Lockwood Phillips.
Viewpoints around the world with Tom Arms of LookAheadNews.com and Look Ahead Radio. Just to remind you, log on to his newsletter at LookAheadNews.com. It's free. Tomorrow's news today, and we're chatting with him after his return flight to London. Tom, with about 5 minutes to go, let's talk about two items. One, particularly of note here recently, was the announcement yesterday of the dismissal of FBI Director James Comey. I'm curious, is that getting much play there in the UK and in Europe? Is that what's the buzz, if you will, on that topic?
Well, it's too early for the mainstream press here to really comment on it. You will see something in the papers tomorrow. You won't get the politicians commenting on it because it's a domestic matter. The electronic media, what's coming over Twitter, the Twitter sphere, is very much on the Democratic Party side on this. They're indicating that they think it is a cover-up or part of a cover-up on the part of the Trump administration. Nothing definite, just that's a sort of feel that you get from reading Twitter sphere, reading some of the electronic media. The BBC has published a long analysis along those lines. And so they're siding more or less with those Democrats in Congress who are worried that the Trump administration has dismissed Director Comey because they're afraid that he's too pro the Russian hacking scandal and will uncover something that he doesn't like or that Donald Trump doesn't like. They're drawing particular attention to the fact that in his letter to the director, the president mentioned that the director said that there was going to be no investigation of Donald Trump personally.
Well, and of course, the Russian story continues to percolate, as we say here in the States. All right, Tom, let's wrap it up with a quick note here on a look-alike for a soccer star,
Lionel Messi.
Oh, Lionel Messi. I'm sorry. Tell us about this.
Well, okay. Have you ever heard of Lionel Messi is my question.
No.
Well, Lionel Messi is like number one soccer star in the world. And this may be hard to believe, but soccer is more popular in the world than American football.
Absolutely. and American football, baseball and basketball combined, I would venture to say. So what is the issue here?
So this chap in Iran actually decided he was going to wear a Lionel Messi T-shirt with the number 10, that's his number, on the back and pose as a lookalike. He was so successful. There's so many people mobbing him as he walked down the street in Iran that the police had to arrest him for his own protection.
My land.
They also impounded his car.
You know, it's interesting. Soccer stars get so much more celebrity status than those in theater and the theatrical arts. It is astounding. We don't have that problem here in the States. I mean, maybe of interest related to a Tom Brady, et cetera, but my goodness, Hollywood stars get that kind of treatment. Most athletes do not here in the States. It's celebrity craziness there in Europe. This was in Iran, so it's the Middle East.
Yes. Yeah, the Far East is even worse.
Wow. All right. Tom Harms with us this afternoon. LookAheadNews.com and Look Ahead Radio. Always to remind you, LookAheadNews.com, a free newsletter. Simply log on, LookAheadNews.com, and get tomorrow's news today. And, of course, listen to him on Look Ahead Radio as well. And we find stations around the world listening to his broadcast every week here, heard, as a matter of fact, here on Fridays on the Talk Station. So, matter of fact, wrapping up this afternoon on the Talk Station, Viewpoints Around the World. Tom, thank you for being with us.
Always a pleasure.
Viewpoints Around the World.
Look Ahead Radio is a production of the Talk Station.